Welcome to the Globe Hockey Roundtable podcast. I'm your host, Darren York, in Toronto, and on the line to talk Habs is our man in Montreal, Sean Gordon. Gordo, how are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Not too bad. Let's start with the leadership question, which has been the big one heading into training camp. I know there isn't a fancy stat for this, but I get the feeling that guys like Gionta and Georges did have a tangible impact on the team with their leadership in the room. I believe you wrote that it was like removing some of the team's still beating heart. So before we talk about the new leadership group, I'll ask you to pontificate on what you think has been lost in the room.
You know, it's an interesting dichotomy because, quite frankly, most of the time around Montreal, if you run a hockey team, telling the truth is not going to win you any friends. And essentially, by getting rid of Gionta, or letting him walk, I should say, and getting rid of Georges via trade, sort of says, look, we are actually in transition. This is not, we're not fooling around. We're not there yet. We're not a team that's fully formed. We have a bunch of players who we need to throw some weight on their shoulders and see how fast they can run with it. And I actually thought that that was kind of an interesting move. And these are guys that have become, over the last 5 years, pretty well ingrained in the team. And when you actually look at who's still around from the great summer clearout of 2009, those were the two biggest names, effectively. And you know, the number of players who are still here relative to that, I mean, I haven't actually gone down the roster and counted, but if it's more than four or five, I'd be very surprised. And so here they are, essentially admitting by deed what they more or less said in words, but is really essentially showing, look, you know what, we are now in a period here where we're switching over from the old guard to the new guard, and now is the time for these guys to show what they got, which I think is kind of odd, which is why I think it's even odder not to have named a captain, not to have picked a guy who you want to hitch your wagon to, at least publicly. I mean, I, as I wrote the other day, part of the reason is that the guy that they're really hitching their wagon to is Carey Price, and he's allowed to wear a seat. But I do find it interesting that they are actually sort of saying, look, we are not there yet. We figure that the guys who were young and needed to learn what it was like to go on a long playoff run, now it's their turn to lead that playoff run next time through, and I think that's kind of interesting.
You touched on the four assistant captain approach that management decided to take.
Alternates, Darren. Alternates. People get really bent out of shape when you say assistant. I don't know why. in French, everybody says assistant. Anyway, I don't know. Alternates.
So some say it makes total sense. Others would argue the team has effectively just punted the decision till next fall. We're going to go through this again. Where do you fall in that range?
I fall comfortably in the middle of that range. There are days where I think to myself, this is just stupid. Let's end the charade, give it to PK, which is what I would have done in the first place. He's flamboyant, yes. He drives people crazy, yes. He's the face of your team. He's your most popular player. He's your best paid player. He's your best player who isn't a goalie. Just do it, right? Hand him the keys and don't worry about it, and let him sink or swim with it. This is not how these guys are wired. And so I understand what they're trying to do here. I understand the idea of spreading the load. I understand the management of the dressing room and trying to go across all of the possible cliques. I'm not convinced that this particular dressing room is as cliquish as some of them have been in the past and maybe that other teams are. But we never really know that because we're not sitting there. And so, yeah, I mean, I see what they were doing, but at the same time, it just sort of, you know, why prolong the agony, essentially? Why make this a topic of conversation next summer the same way that it was this summer? You know, I guess the idea, the cynical view of that is that it will paper over whatever shortcomings the team has because it will give something people to give a point for people to focus on. But I don't know. It sort of seems to me that if you are saying that the team is in flux, if you are saying that the team is in transition, then you need to put people in actual roles of authority to see how they handle them. And this is kind of half a loaf. And I don't know how much you're actually going to learn from this experiment this year. This being said, the last time they didn't have a captain, they went to conference final.
Before we totally move on to the season, I should ask, because we haven't spoken since the end of last year, can you give us your kind of Coles Notes take on why the Subban contract situation worked out the way it did?
Yeah, I actually, I My sense, as we get farther away from this, my sense is actually that, you know, a lot of people, and let's rewind for a second. A lot of the people at the time that this all went down were saying, "Oh my God, Bergevin has screwed up. It's an irredeemable screw up on Bergevin's part." I'm not convinced that that's the case. I think this was a negotiation where both sides were going to push it to the max to see who would flinch first, and in the end, they both kind of half flinched. And I actually do think, this is not the sort of thing that anyone will ever admit, even on the record or off. But my firm sense from talking to people around this contract negotiation is that some money was left on the table by PK Subban and Donnie Meehan. And I think that the original ask might have been a little bit higher than what ultimately was agreed to, $9 million annual average value. And the team, I think, in a lot of ways, is blamed for letting it drag on and for not just signing him to the big money contract when it was easier to do so. Except that when you actually look at it from their perspective, they wanted to see how far they could go with the player, I think. And they wanted to see, given what they learned from the previous negotiation, how it would impact the other side's decision-making as crunch time got closer. And fundamentally, neither side seems to have any ill feelings that they're willing to discuss with a reporter. And I think ultimately this ended up more or less where both sides figured it would, and that having to go through the arbitration was probably something that they would have preferred not to do. But I think both sides understood that in order for the leverage to be evenly applied, that they both needed to do it. So fundamentally, there are people who are going to say that the bridge contract that he signed 3 years ago was a bad idea. I think Bergevin was brilliant with that, because now instead of having PK signed to 5 or 6 years on Erik Karlsson money and having to renegotiate with him at age 28 or 29, they've essentially bought up all his UFA years between the ages of 28 and 33, and by going the extra 4 years, so 29 and 33. And so this contract might seem like a huge pinch at the moment, but I'm going to suggest to you that in 5, 6, 7 years, it's going to look like a pretty good bargain, because by then, Noah Hanifin and Seth Jones are going to be making $15 million a year on a $105 million cap.
And then we'll have a lockout.
Well, we might have a lockout before then, but yeah, and you know what? This is the other thing, is essentially this contract gets the Habs basically to the next lockout with PK, which is not a bad situation to be in. And let's face it, $9 billion a year. I mean, look, that's pretty good bank. And I think Mr. Subban has not only the money and the financial security and the term that he was looking for, he also has the prestige of having signed the richest contract in the history of the Montreal Canadiens, which is now into its 103rd year.
Galchenyuk seems to be a guy a lot of people are pointing to as key this year. What does the team need from him this season?
Well, you know, not much. 30 goals, 80 points. You know, I'm exaggerating. They don't need that much. They would like for this year to be a Tyler Seguin-like breakout year. I don't necessarily expect that to happen. It wouldn't surprise me if it did, though. This kid has amazing talent. I think one of the reasons that he hasn't had a really serious, sustained kind of emerging superstar type breakout is mostly because of injuries, and the fact that, unlike, say, a Nathan MacKinnon, whose game is more NHL ready because of the strength and power that he has physically, and because of the game that he plays, I mean, Galchenyuk plays a little bit more of what you might describe as a finesse game. And I think that had he not been injured last year, you would have seen more progress. I think this guy is going to be a huge factor in the Montreal Canadiens season, mostly because if you have a lineup where, especially if he can play some in the middle, the Habs become an extremely difficult team to defend. And I think that with the balance that you could get, having a guy like that chip in 25, 30 goals this year, it makes the Habs, I would say, assuming that he can deliver on that kind of promise and live up to that sort of production, maybe not a point a game, but say somewhere between 60 and 80 points this year. If he can deliver that level of production, I think that transforms the Habs from a pretty good Eastern Conference team to an elite Eastern Conference team, mostly because their biggest problem last year was scoring goals 5-on-5. They had kind of crummy special teams and weren't playing with the puck as much. This guy is so skilled and so good and so confident that I think if you have him as a second line or third line player, the other teams are going to end up having to either play their second and third defensive pairings against Max Pacioretty, which is not a good way to succeed, or they're going to have to do it against Alex Galchenyuk, which is also not a good way to succeed. And so I think he is really, really key. And I don't know necessarily, like I say, that at age 20, he's a guy who is going to take a huge step forward and become Tyler Seguin and finish in the top 10 or 15 in scoring in the National Hockey League. But he certainly has the skills and ability to do that. And I think it's more or less a matter of time, assuming that he doesn't suffer any more catastrophic injuries, that it happens at some point in the next two or three seasons. He is the guy with Pacioretty and with guys like Brendan Gallagher and Carey Price and PK Subban, all of whom are signing long-term, Lars Eller. These are the guys who are going to make the Habs into a, I would say, Stanley Cup contending team shortly, within 2 years. And I think if everything breaks right, these are the guys who can help them get back to the stage where they have parades in Montreal in July or June, whenever the hockey season ends, July.
I was just going to ask, Uncle Chelnick, like you touched on it there, with the injuries he's had, I know he's young, but is there any kind of creeping concern there that maybe he's a guy who's going to struggle to stay healthy?
Yeah, I think there might be. If he gets injured again this year, I think probably there would be, because you're in a situation where this guy needs to play a lot of games and needs to play pressure minutes and heavy minutes, and he needs to do it in circumstances that are favorable to him and to his development. And that basically means that he needs to play 70-plus games in an NHL season if you want to get him to the point where you're going to be able to rely on him as a stud number one center, which is what they drafted him at. He may end up just being a stud number one or number two left winger, which is also a nice thing to have, but I think in the middle is where they would really like him to flourish. And so if he goes through another season like last year where he misses significant amounts of time with injuries, and the kinds of injuries that can diminish him. Last year he had a knee. He also had a broken hand, which is no big deal.
He had a knee in junior, right? His knee rebuilt his last year.
He had a knee in junior, that's right. And you know, you start to think to yourself, well, all right, what do we got here? What can this guy actually do? And I actually think that he is committed enough to his physical preparation and is a big boned kid and a solidly built kid and a gym rat and all that other good stuff, and by most accounts is a very clean living guy. Sort of seems to me that probably this is the year where he gets to that 75 game barrier, right, where he doesn't miss more than a couple of games here and there because of flu or, you know, whatever else. And I think that this will be a year where you also see him now growing into his body a little bit more. He's a little heavier, a little stronger than he was. It sort of seems to me that this is kind of where it happens for him. As far as demonstrating that he can be a physically reliable man in the National Hockey League.
Alexi Emelin spent a lot of time on the right side last year, and Habs fans I know describe his play as I heard phrases like tire fire, hot garbage at times. I guess with the addition of Gilbert, he's going to move to the left side. How do you see him slotting in this year in the top six? He obviously has to have a much better year.
I actually saw him slotting in with Gilbert on his second pair, and depending on how Nathan Beaulieu comes along and possibly Jarrett Dinardi, I actually figured that there was an excellent chance that he could be a third-pairing guy by the end of the season, which is what I actually think he is. And incredibly, Michel Therrien in training camp is playing him with PK Subban. And I got to tell you, that is just not a good idea, because Alexi Emelin, whether you play him on the right, whether you play him on the left, his problem is not getting his bearings on the ice. His problem is hockey sense. He just doesn't read the play that well. And he takes himself out of situations. And I don't think that he's a guy that you can play against other top lines with. And I don't think Tom Gilbert is a guy that you can play against other top lines with, assuming that you see Andre Markov and Gilbert as a number one or 1A pairing. And yet this appears to be, at least in the early going of camp, what Therrien wants to do. And this just makes absolutely no sense to me. And I guess we'll see what happens when the shooting starts for real. But it just sort of seems to me like, look, what are you doing here? Why are you in a circumstance where you're avoiding the obvious, which is to play your two best puck-moving guys, both of whom have serious offensive abilities. Why are you not playing them together? This doesn't make any sense to me. And then having the possibility of using Emlyn and Gilbert against opposing second and third lines, where they're not going to be required to play as much of a shutdown role, and where they can probably have a little bit more favorable matchups. And you can even play your second pair, which is what Therrien did a lot last year. He would play PK Subban with inferior forward players, knowing that Subban could cover up a lot of deficiencies there. Then you could probably put Gilbert and Emelin out with possibly the Plekanec line, or possibly even Deharne at the top unit. I don't know. I can't really figure out what Therrien's doing. It may also just be, look, it's training camp stuff. We want to see. We already know that Markov and Subban can make beautiful music together. Maybe it's just a question of trying to see what you have with Gilbert and trying to see what you have with Emelin playing on his natural side. And I mean, look, maybe that's all it is. Maybe sometimes a cigar is just a cigar. But it sort of seems to me that it's a bit curious for Therrien to be doing this in this fashion at this particular stage of the game. And I guess we'll find out more fulsomely as camp grinds on what it is that they want to do when the season starts.
So that would leave one of the kids to play with Mike Weaver. For those of us who don't see every Habs game, can you kind of compare and contrast the two kids?
Yeah, Beaulieu is a prototypical power play quarterback gambler. You've got with Tenorti more of a prototypical smash mouth, 6'6" physical stay at home guy. Although Tenorti has shown a lot more rushing ability in the last sort of half a week than he did probably most of last year. Beaulieu is a much better skater. Tenorti is a much heavier player. And I think that you could also sort of think of Beaulieu as a left-handed Subban. The knock against him, which I think is unfair, is going to be that he's an arsonist in his own end. All defensemen make mistakes. It's just more obvious when offensive defensemen and guys who are really good with the puck make mistakes. They always have it, right? It's like Erik Karlsson. I don't understand people who complain about Erik Karlsson. I would take Erik Karlsson in my team 100% of the time. I don't care what that team is. So that's basically the way that those guys shape down. There's another youngster who is going to get a lot of ink over the course of training camp, but who I don't actually think has a realistic shot because he's a right-handed shot, which is Greg Patteron. He's the guy that they acquired from the Leafs in the Mikhail Grabowski trade. Mm-hmm. And he's a late bloomer, college player, right-handed shot, as I said. Bigger guy, showed some offensive upside basically for the first time in his career last year in Hamilton before he got hurt. And I know the organization likes him, and he's a guy that will probably feature at some point in Montreal. But I'm not convinced that it's going to be at the beginning of the season, mostly because Weaver is a known quantity. Weaver is on a team-friendly deal. Weaver is a funny guy who gets along well. He's a veteran who is, from all outward appearances anyway, quite appreciated as far as his teammates and all that stuff. So I don't know. It just sort of seems to me that that you've got three guys basically competing for one spot. I think Beaulieu, because of his skating, because of the fact he plays the left side, because of the fact that you can throw him out in the second power play unit, he's going to look a little better on the second power play unit than Frankie Bouillon did last year, I think. It just sort of seems to me that he's the obvious guy, unless he really has a terrible camp, who is going to start the season in Montreal on the third pair. And I wouldn't be surprised, as I said, if as the season grinds on, he were to show that he can be more than that.
Not that they don't have other interesting prospects, but I don't see anyone else who's really knocking on the door. Do you see any surprises? Or it looks like there's a bit of a gap between the next wave.
Yeah, I don't see too many huge surprises, to be honest. I mean, I could see a guy like Sven Andraghetto, who was a second or third round pick a couple of years ago, who is a very nifty offensive player. I could see him being a guy who sticks with the team to open the air. I could see...
He is the classic undersized Montreal forward, yes?
He's the classic undersized Montreal forward, yeah. He's a thick guy, but he's only about 5'9". But he's got a lot of skill, and he can play a little center. He can play a little left side. He can play a little right side. They don't have a huge number of gifted offensive players kicking around, and so I think that he's got to be a guy that you have to look at. The other kid that everyone's talking about is Jacob Delarose, who was drafted in 2013, who is a man. He's a big, big kid, left-handed shot, mostly plays the left side, which is not really where the need is, unless you move Rene Bourque to the right side, which they could. Delarose, it sort of seems to me, is more of a bottom six guy. I don't think he's got a lot of offensive upside, but he is skating-wise, physically-wise, attitudin-wise. I mean, he's the classic Swedish, just shut up and play guy. He's a guy who I think is going to get a long look. I think that Jiří Sekáč, who was the free agent, the KHL free agent that they signed in the offseason and who was highly sought after from a bunch of different teams, he's a guy who I think is probably right now penciled in as the 12th or 13th guy who's able to move up and down the lineup a little bit. They're trying him on the right side. He's mostly been a left winger. He's a guy who, because he's a little bit older, 22, 23, and he's played pro, skates like the wind. Jury's still out on whether he's going to have any offensive success at the National Hockey League level, primarily because it's kind of a big jump, you know, KHL-wise. If you look at some of the goals that he scored in the K last year, it sort of seems to me that a bunch of those goals don't happen in the National Hockey League with bigger and faster defensemen. Mm-hmm. So it'll be interesting to see. Those are basically, these are all guys who are scrambling and scraping for effectively one job up front, that may or may not be a full-time, job depending on how Mikhail Bourneval plays and according to need, right? So they're fighting over table scraps at this point. The lineup of this team is fairly well set. The other guy, actually, who in the early stages of the camp has impressed a lot of people, but I can't imagine that they would do this, even though he resembles Alex Galchenyuk in almost every way, is Nikita Sherbak, who was their first-round pick from last summer. He's the only player that they drafted in 2014 who is at camp. He's a dynamic guy. He's got good size. He's got good wheels. Except that I don't know that you can necessarily have one 18-year-old and one just turned 20-year-old kid in your lineup at this stage of the game. But who knows? I mean, you know, it's one of those things where he will have a chance to blow their doors off in camp, and he may do the same thing that Galchenyuk did last time around, although I kind of think that it's, as I said, it sort of seems to me that it's not going to happen, mostly because, you know, the Habs broke with long tradition a couple of years ago, bringing Galchenyuk in as an 18-year-old, and it's hard to imagine that they would do it twice in 3 years.
Last one, Gordo. Who's the backup goalie for this team?
Oh, good grief. You know what? I got to tell you, only in Montreal do people get exercised about who should be the second or third string goaltender.
It happens in the city, too.
I suppose this happens in Toronto. You know what? God love Canadian hockey markets. It's fantastic. I actually think probably that Peter Budaj has the inside track. The only reason I think that is because of the personal relationship that he has with Carey Price. And he's had the good sense to get very close to Carey. And I think Carey likes having his buddy Boods around. And not that he doesn't like Dustin Tokarski. On the contrary, I think he likes him quite a lot. It's just that when you look at track record, when you look at what the role is, when you look at essentially what the main dimensions of that role entail, it's not being able necessarily to win games. It's getting along with the main guy, not being a threat to him, and putting up token resistance on shooting drills in practice, right? And I kind of think that maybe Budaj is the guy because he's signed. Now, if they're looking to make some moves and acquire some other players, I could see them going with Tokarski. One thing that seems fairly certain is that if Budaj totally lays an egg in the preseason games, then I could see them maybe deciding that, all right, they can move on with them, mostly because I think Tokarski gets claimed on waivers, and Budaj probably doesn't, mostly because he's got a one-way contract and he's making a little bit more money. And so, you know, I could see them starting the season with Budaj and Price. I could also see them starting the season with Price and Tokarski and putting Budaj through the waiver system and sending him to Hamilton for a few weeks to see how it goes. But it just sort of seems to me that this is, you know, for a fairly conservative organization, knowing what they've got is probably better than taking a chance on something that they don't, even though they served up the ultimate insult to Budaj in the playoffs and started Tokarski ahead of them. I just sort of seems to me that that's kind of the way that it's the most logical and obvious way to do it. And Mark Bergevin is nothing if he isn't the logical guy.
All right, we'll leave it there, Goro. Good to talk to you again, and we'll catch up before the season starts.
You are more than welcome, Darren, and this is always good fun, and I almost can't believe that hockey is upon us, and look at that, looming in the near distance.
2,000 words on the backup goalie situation for Saturday, please.
I'm sure it will be read, criticized, and heavily commented on, I have no doubt.
Take care, Goro.
Thank you.